Welcome to the Battery Technology Podcast with me, Ken Davis.
Sponsored by Munters, experts in climate control systems for safe, high quality battery cell production and R&D, delivering stable, low dew point conditions whilst minimizing energy use.
Episode 20, Developments in Sodium Ion Battery Technology. Many of the preceding episodes in this series are focused on lithium. But of course, lithium isn't the only potential alkali metal that lends itself to use as a battery material. In this episode, we explore the growing interest in sodium ion battery technology and where that fits in the landscape of developing technologies and what the future holds for sodium ion batteries. I'm helped in this by Spencer Gore, CEO of Bedrock Materials, a pioneer in the development of sodium ion batteries and the perfect partner to help us understand just where sodium ion battery technology fits in to the future.
I am delighted to be joined by Spencer Gore, CEO of Bedrock Materials. Bedrock Materials are a business very much at the forefront of developments around the commercialization of sodium ion batteries, a subject that I'm fascinated to hear more about. So firstly, a very warm welcome to the Battery Technology Podcast, Spencer.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ken. Really happy to be here today with you.
Well, it's a good place to start, maybe, just to kind of understand a little bit more about your personal journey in terms of how you got involved with the battery technology field itself and how that's led you to become CEO of Bedrock Materials.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty interesting story. In fact, like most of my colleagues, found my way into the battery industry by accident. For me, it was about 10 years ago when I was still in college. And as a student studying physics, I had been taking a couple of my summers and semesters off to be an intern at SpaceX. Mm-hmm. Specifically, I was on the avionics engineering team for Falcon 9. And a little bit out of the blue, I actually exchanged Facebook messages with the Tesla intern page. So they had a Facebook intern page, and they would message people. I think specifically they saw people that were working at SpaceX trying to recruit them. And so that turned into a couple of phone calls, which after that turned into an internship at Tesla, which turned into another one, and then my first full-time job. So straight out of college, I joined the battery module engineering team at Tesla. So this is the group that was responsible for designing the mechanical assemblies that held the thousands of, you know, cylindrical 18650 battery cells into a high voltage battery pack. I was specifically working on some of the thermal subsystems and structures inside of the battery pack. And was mostly involved with the long range 100 kilowatt hour battery program that upgraded the Model S, you know, around 2016. I stayed at Tesla through the release of the Model 3 designs at about that time before I left to start my first company, which was called Impossible Aerospace. And Impossible Aerospace was a company that commercialized a new approach to the design of battery powered aircraft, specifically drones. You know, we realized that one of the biggest pain points that was facing the commercial drone industry was the very short flight time of battery-powered unmanned systems. A typical drone is flying 15 or 20 minutes on a charge back in 2016, and this really prevented them from doing any kind of commercially useful work. And so at Impossible, we basically took some inspiration from the way that Tesla had designed a car around its battery pack. And we built what I like to say were flying batteries, structures that were shaped like a drone, but the structures themselves were a battery pack, and we just attached propellers. Ran that business for 5 years, took a small acquisition in 2020, and then after that, I went back to Stanford for a master's degree in material science. That's where I met my co-founder, and have been working with, advising, working for several other battery technology companies, mostly in Silicon Valley ever since. Maybe the one notable one is Enovix, where I worked as the head of EV products for some time before starting Bedrock Materials.
Well, thanks for that. It's always interesting to understand how people arrive at the place that we meet them at, and that's a great explanation. I appreciate it. So, I guess the first question I should ask is a big question, which is why are sodium ion batteries necessary at all, given the huge amount of infrastructure and research which is taking place on the lithium side? And as far as I understand it, remembering back in the day, lithium ion batteries, sodium ion batteries invented around the same time, really. But why is it now that sodium ion batteries are becoming of such great interest?
Yeah, it's a really great question, and it's one that I'm often asked. Sodium ion batteries are definitely having a moment right now, and I think it's really fair to ask why. And 10 years ago, back when I was working on designing EV batteries, the requirements for the battery technology we were looking for were very different than they are today. 10 years ago, the effort was all about making electric vehicles that could drive further, charge faster, go 0 to 60 in 2 seconds, because we were trying to sell cars to rich people at $140,000 a pop. And in that case, performance is really the only thing that matters. Cost is secondary. Today, things are very different. Pretty much every electric vehicle on the market can drive 300 miles or close to it. They pretty much all charge up to 80% in about 20-ish minutes. They'll all go 0 to 60 in, 3 or 4 seconds. Performance is kind of table stakes now. The problem that automakers face is now cost. Electric vehicles are not making money for most major automakers, and they're not selling in lump in numbers that are large enough to justify their product SKUs. And if you dig into the consumer acceptance data of why they're not selling, the answer is pretty clear. It's cost. It's hard to sell an electric vehicle for $10,000 more than a comparable gas-powered version, especially with interest rates where they are today. And so that's really why sodium-ion batteries are necessary. It's not because they're a more advanced or a better battery technology. It's because they're a cheaper technology. You can make sodium-ion batteries out of largely earth-abundant minerals, mostly iron, manganese, sodium, aluminum. And this provides the pathway to ultimately get to the cost point that will be accessible to the mass market, and in particular in emerging economies where we still have not seen electrification begin to penetrate.
One of the things I think we should define early on in this conversation, I think, is how sodium ion batteries compare performance-wise to lithium ion batteries. I think it's very important to get that defined, and then we can, I think, dig into some of the decisions which are being made in terms of what's going to drive the sodium ion battery industry.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And a lot of, I should say, much like lithium-ion batteries, sodium-ion batteries encompass a wide variety of different technologies. There are a number of different cathode options and anode options which can construct a sodium-ion battery. And depending on which set you choose, the performance specifications will vary. But to come at this from a broad stroke, the benchmark that we use on the lithium-ion side as the comparison would be your conventional lithium iron phosphate and graphite cell. That's baseline chemistry that's common now in a number of standard range vehicles like the Tesla Model 3, standard range. And so the question is, relative to that, what do these different sodium ion formulations deliver in terms of performance? The highest performing sodium ion technology out there is on the cathode side using what's called a layered transition metal oxide. And I'll get back to why I say that's the highest performing in just a minute. Relative to lithium iron phosphate and graphite, that technology delivers about 25% less volumetric energy density and about 25% less gravimetric energy density, or what we call specific energy. On the other performance specifications, though, you actually have an advantage for sodium in many cases. So sodium-ion batteries perform quite well in cold weather. They charge rather quickly. The cycle life depends on the particular technology that you choose, and depends on how, much like lithium-ion batteries, depends on how you you operate the cell. And so it's hard to give an apples-to-apples comparison. Most of the technologies we're seeing have no problem meeting the automotive requirements for cycle life and calendar life. And so really, it's a question of how we think about electric vehicles that can work with batteries that are a little bit less energy dense, and then how we can take the sodium ion technology and upgrade it over time to ultimately match and then kind of pass the low end of lithium iron phosphate and graphite in energy density.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
Ignite breakthroughs in solid-state battery R&D with Vicella, your dedicated partner in trustworthy dew point measurement. Vicella's state-of-the-art solutions cater to your lab experiments and scaling up needs. Contact us at vicella.com/battery.
One thing you didn't mention there, but I just think might be worth mentioning, is what are the safety comparisons? Because clearly, you know, lithium, you know, when lithium gets into a thermal runaway situation, it's pretty ferocious. What's the situation in relation to sodium? How does it compare in terms of that safety perspective?
Yeah, you know, safety, battery safety is a really complicated topic. Because it means one thing for a battery cell to have a quote safer chemistry. But the reality is, from my former life as a battery pack engineer, I've been given a lot of cells from cell vendors that were said to be very safe. And then you build a pack out of thousands of them, and you still need to employ considerable countermeasures at the pack level in order to deliver a safe product. Right. And so there's a start with that distinction, that there's a difference between cell level safety and pack level safety. In general, it looks like when you're comparing sodium ion batteries of comparable chemistries to their lithium counterparts. So for example, comparing a sodium-based layered oxide cell to a lithium-based layered oxide cell, it looks like the sodium cells will have a bit of a safety edge. And then the reason is they just have a lower energy density. And so it's hard to be more dangerous when there's less fuel there to begin with. But much like lithium ion, sodium ion cells encompass a wide variety of cathode and anode technologies, and they all have their own safety profiles. We're really in the early days here of understanding just how significant of an advantage this really is.
And I'm going to play devil's advocate here, and I'm sure you've been asked this question a million times, but I should ask it anyway. A lot of people who talk to me about the challenges around adoption of electric vehicles talk about range anxiety. I mean, how does essentially a solution that talks about a lower energy density, how do you overcome that from a developer of sodium ion batteries when, you know, clearly that is a bit of an issue in the market as a whole?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And it leads to a kind of counterintuitive answer. So, you know, years ago, back when the cost of electric vehicles didn't matter, the energy density of the battery cell is really what determined the range of the car. And of course, in combination with aerodynamics and powertrain efficiency. And that's because automakers were filling up all of the available space in a car's battery with cells. Today, in many vehicle trims and on many vehicle platforms, it's actually not energy density limited, it's cost limited. And what I mean by that is, I'll give you an example. One of the products that I worked on at Tesla was the 75 kilowatt hour Model S. That was a product where we started with a 100 kilowatt hour battery pack, and we removed battery cells to reach a target cost so that we can sell more of them. That's an example of a platform that was not energy density constrained, it was cost constrained. The only way to increase the range of that vehicle is to deliver a lower cost battery cell that would allow the customer to be able to afford more range, and we had extra space in the battery pack to do it. It turns out that most EVs out there, you'll see, have different trims. So you have your standard range, your extended range, maybe your extended range plus, and everything except the longest range product has empty space in it. And so that's an indication that we're actually not energy density limited, we're cost limited. And so that's a long way of saying that range anxiety actually is cost anxiety. We could build a 600-mile car today. The engineering allows us to do it. Nobody would buy it because it costs too much. So we got to bring cell costs down. Now I'll caveat that by saying that that is true for a number of vehicle categories and trims, like sedans, certain crossover platforms. It's not yet true for for example, large SUVs or pickup trucks. There, we really do have an energy density problem, and sodium ion won't be appropriate except in perhaps fleet applications where short range, daily use is really the norm.
And is this intrinsically bound up, therefore, in the success or otherwise of charging infrastructure, in the sense of actually, if the charging infrastructure is right and it's reliable and it's available, actually a lot of these problems in terms of range anxiety just kind of naturally go away?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The charging infrastructure is one of three main trends that have made this really an opportune time to consider these lower energy density chemistries. So the charging infrastructure, yes, that's the first one. Relative to where we were 10 years ago, we have orders of magnitude more public charging stations available, and charging rates are over four times as fast. You know, you can get 250, 350 kilowatts of charging speed from a supercharger, an SAE combo station. The second big trend is that automakers have gotten really good at battery packaging. So considerably less space is wasted inside of a modern electric vehicle battery pack relative to where we were 10 years ago. And that's just because the people who are doing what I used to do, packaging batteries, are way better at it than we used to be. And that allows you to get more performance out of a lower energy density cell. I should say higher energy density at the pack level given the same cell. And then the last trend is that electric vehicles have become much more efficient. So take a 2013 Tesla Model S. That did about 87 miles per gallon equivalent, or there's also an equivalent in watt hours per mile. You can buy a Hyundai today that does 160, and it's not all that much smaller. It's really because motors have gotten more efficient, drive electronics have improved, HVAC and aerodynamics have all just allowed us to consume less energy per mile driven, which means energy density is again worth less than it used to be.
One final question before we move into the chemistry. Just what is the comparison of cost of a lithium battery to a sodium ion battery?
Yeah, well, of course, the exact cost of lithium and sodium technologies depends a lot on the specific chemistry that you're using and then also the day-to-day metals markets. So it's hard to tell you a price today that's going to be true tomorrow. But what most credible industry estimates suggest is that the cost floor of sodium ion technology, without getting into anything too exotic, is about half that of lithium ion. And that comes from a few places. First of all, you're getting rid of all the lithium. Even if lithium is cheap, it's not free. You're getting rid of the copper current collectors in the cell. For some fun material science reasons, you can use aluminum. You are replacing a graphite anode, which at least mostly comes from needle coke that's been calcined at a very high temperature, replacing that with hard carbon, which usually comes from a biosource and is calcined at a lower temperature, and so it's a less energy intensive process. Still some work to do to get the cost down, but it's improving every day. And then the electrolytes, for various reasons we can talk more about, are also projected to be much lower cost. And so it's actually a number of small wins across the board. It's really not just the absence of lithium that causes sodium ion batteries to look pretty good in their long-term cost roadmap.
It's a good segue, really, that to just talking in a bit more detail about the chemistry of what we're involved with here. Sodium, very similar in terms of its chemical properties to lithium, alkali metal. Just talk us through an overview of sodium ion chemistry, the similarities to lithium, the differences to lithium.
At a very high level, so the operating principle of a sodium ion battery and a lithium ion battery is virtually the same. So you are shuttling lithium ions between the cathode and the anode when you're in the discharged and charged states, respectively. On each side, you have some kind of a host material that on the cathode, the sodium ions are intercalating into, much like lithium ion. There's a little bit of a difference on the anode in that there's not really a great intercalation material for sodium ion batteries. We'll talk about that more in a second. We're shuttling sodium ions back and forth. Just like a lithium ion, it has a plus one charge, which means that the salt that we're using in the electrolyte is generally the same as lithium ion salt, just we've replaced the sodium, replaced with sodium. So instead of using LiPF6, we're using NaPF6. The materials on the cathode and anode side have a lot in common with lithium ion batteries. So on the cathode side, there are three main families of materials that the industry has looked at. The first one is called a Prussian blue analog, or sometimes known as Prussian white in its fully sodiated state. This is a material that's based on usually a couple different transition metals, maybe iron and manganese, and then it's a hexacyanoferrate. So there's kind of six cyanide groups that are hanging off of one of the transition metals. The positives to this material are that the specific capacity, meaning the gravimetric energy density, is really high. The voltage is also pretty high. And the bill of materials cost is low because it's based on usually very earth-abundant metals. There are a few downsides to that material. One of them is that it seems like at moderate temperatures, it tends to give off some hydrogen cyanide gas. A bit of a problem. If we kind of take that problem off the table, the thing that makes Prussian blue and Prussian white really challenging is that its volumetric capacity is low. It's a very low density material. And what that means is that the cells that we would be making have a low volumetric energy density. And the reason that's a problem, beyond being, unsuitable for a car, is that it makes producing those cells in a real battery factory expensive, because each battery cell coming off the end of the line is now generating less revenue. Your equipment depreciation costs go up. All right, so that's one family. The second family are polyanion materials. So just like we have lithium iron phosphate out there, as a polyanion lithium ion material, there are a category of sodium ion materials called, that are also polyanionic. One of the common ones we're starting to see some progress on is sodium iron pyrophosphate. And so this is a material that has lower specific capacity, has a little bit lower voltage, and so the energy density is not great, but the cycle performance looks to be pretty strong. And so there's some promise of this material set for use cases like grid-scale energy storage, much like we're using lithium iron phosphate for grid-scale energy storage. And then the last, and this is actually the most, the broadest category of materials that are used in the cathode, are the layered transition metal oxides. These have been the most popular materials for many years. They have a lot in common with NCM-type materials that are used in lithium-ion batteries, only we're using different transition metals. The most common formulations are based on nickel, iron, and manganese, but there are a number of other transition metals that can be used in them that are also electrochemically active and actually uniquely active for sodium that don't necessarily work with lithium. So copper is a good example, titanium, and chromium are some transition metals that work that don't really make sense with lithium ion. The advantages to layered transition metal oxides are largely that the volumetric capacity is very high, quite a bit higher than any of the other chemistries. And that's even though the specific capacity, so our gravimetric energy density, is not quite as high. From our perspective, that volumetric energy density is what makes the layered oxides particularly attractive for automotive applications, where our customers, and we could talk more about this in a minute, our customers are screaming, asking for higher volumetric energy density, and they're willing to trade away weight to do it. That's, we see a lot of promise in the layered oxide material set for that reason. On the anode side, largely what we're talking about is instead of using graphite, we're using hard carbon. What is hard carbon? You can think of it as amorphous graphite. So you have a kind of disordered sheets of graphene that are meshed together at some kind of they're not parallel to each other. The main sodium storage mechanisms in hard carbon are still being understood, but it's not a clean intercalation like it is with graphite and lithium. It seems like sodium stores itself inside the nanopores in these materials. That's one of the storage locations. It also finds its way into the edge defects of the material, and then also kind of pseudo intercalates in between graphene sheets that maybe have a little bit of a bigger spacing between them.
That gives it some advantages over graphite. in terms of what you're talking about there is something which is slightly more disordered, it sounds like, than the certainly engineered graphite that I know. I mean, are there distinct advantages to that?
Yeah, there are some interesting advantages to hard carbon. One of them is that because you have multiple storage mechanisms, so you're storing both in the nanopores and then also needs edge defects. By changing the morphology of the particle and kind of the ratio of those types of defects, you can tune the material for power or energy or longevity. So it gives another design lever that really didn't exist as much with graphite. And hard carbon looks to be a pretty rate-capable anode material, and the specific capacity actually has a roadmap to take us higher than graphite. So it's a really good material, pretty good material from a gravimetric standpoint. The downside is it is not as volumetrically dense as graphite, and it's actually not close. It's like it's a little bit better than half. And what that means is, why are sodium-ion batteries less energy dense than lithium-ion batteries? It actually has nothing to do with the sodium. It has to do with this hard carbon. The hard carbon is what's taking up all the space in the battery cell. And so there's a very strong motivation to find a next generation sodium ion anode. An example of that is tin. Tin is an alloying material, so it behaves with sodium much the same way that silicon behaves with lithium. And if you can find ways to even use a small amount of tin in the anode, that can help to save a lot of space in the battery cell and increase energy density.
One of the things you mentioned earlier, which you just want to touch on quickly, is the electrolyte. And I think you mentioned earlier that actually there's some significant savings from a cost perspective in terms of some of the electrolyte choices you can make with sodium ion compared to lithium ion. Just can you expand on that slightly for me?
There are a couple of reasons that it looks like the electrolytes in the long run can be cheaper. Obviously, we're still early days and we need to scale production to realize a lot of these savings. But obviously, the first reason is that instead of using LiPF6, we're using NaPF6, and saving in the lithium costs is meaningful. The second reason is that just because of the solvation energy of these ions, or put differently, it seems to be easier for sodium ions to be mobile in electrolyte than it is for lithium ions. We can actually get away with using less salt in the first place, and still get pretty good performance. And so that means we're using a smaller amount of a cheaper salt, which helps bring down the cost of the electrolyte by quite a bit. The other thing that is exciting is because we've gone away from using a graphite anode, some of the electrolyte solvents, which were previously not possible with lithium-ion batteries, are now back on the table. An example is propylene carbonate, and then also several ethers, which again, these would be incompatible with graphite materials. That allows for a number of interesting things you can do at the cell level. One of them is by changing the proportion of carbonates, you can unlock lower temperature performance, which is a really nice way to differentiate a sodium ion cell from a lithium ion cell.
To what degree, if there's large-scale adoption of sodium ion compared to lithium ion in the future, is this technology, is it drop-in technology in the sense of will manufacturers have to fundamentally change their manufacturing operations to accommodate sodium ion, or is it something which that transition is a relatively straightforward one?
Yeah, that's really the billion-dollar question here, is how difficult is it to make sodium-ion cells on lithium-ion production lines? And we've talked to a lot of our customers about this, and the industry seems to have kind of reached a consensus here. First of all, producing sodium-ion batteries can absolutely be done on lithium-ion equipment. It is the same manufacturing process. We're still mixing slurries, coating electrodes, cutting and stacking electrodes, and filling and sealing. It's nothing has changed about that. And so the expertise that battery makers have gained by making lithium-ion cells can be applied to making sodium-ion cells, and there's nothing new that they necessarily need to learn. Now, the cost to convert over a line that is today running lithium-ion batteries to run sodium-ion batteries are a few fold. One, there's just the equipment downtime and cleaning to run a new chemistry, and this is a reason that cell makers don't like switching chemistries. They can do it, but it's good to be avoided if possible. There's some switching costs. There's some recalibrating to do whenever you have a new material set. So, for example, we have new slurry rheologies. We have new cycle times on drying, for example. And then because there might be some new, for example, new cycle times in certain processes, your line may be slightly out of proportion. And so you may have actually wanted to have a longer drying line than you have today. And so that's all to say that you can absolutely produce sodium ion batteries on an existing lithium ion production line. But if you wanted the line to be as efficient as possible, you would probably start by designing the line around the chemistry. And that's true of every lithium ion chemistry out there today, right? So this isn't really unique in that sense.
It's true of every process, irrespective of whether we're talking about batteries or not.
Yep, exactly.
So I guess a good way to kind of bring this to a conclusion, which has been an absolutely fascinating discussion, is where are you in terms of the road to commercialization? What's the next steps? What are the milestones ahead of you? Where are you going to be if we are having this conversation in 5 years' time?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so we're running towards commercialization as fast as we can. We spent the first 6 months of the company, so middle of last year, really talking to all of the world's battery manufacturers and automakers and trying to understand what it was that they were looking from sodium ion battery technology to be competitive, what it would have to do. And we took that time to make sure that we were down selecting to the right technology. And we think that we have. So now it's really our next steps are to be sampling material kind of at the kilogram scale to most of these major customers. And we're actively today producing precursor and cathode active materials in-house. The next kind of year is really going to be focused on making sure that we've got the formulation and the properties of the material exactly right before we start scaling too much. But for us, year three is when we really begin pilot production and producing materials at kind of a ton scale per batch. And even that is actually not that much material, right? If you kind of work out what does a single modern lithium ion production line need to cut over to using sodium ion battery materials, it's about 10,000 tons a year of material, which corresponds to hundreds of millions of dollars. There's a good factory build on our side required to do that. But the good news is that we're essentially building lithium ion electrode material production capacity. The production processes are much the same. This is a pretty well-worn path, and there are experts in the world who know how to go through the scale-up. So we just need to go down that journey. So we think that, reaching actual mass production scale happens at the end of the fourth year of our business. And so we're really right now just working to make sure that we're qualified with the right customers so that we have offtake ready to go when we get there.
We're already starting to see the use of sodium ion batteries in some of the Chinese models, which are starting to appear. So it's clearly looking at the wind is blowing favorably in your direction, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. Sodium ion is exciting, I think, to me, because this is really the first new battery chemistry that has crossed the chasm from the lab to being on the market in a big way in basically my lifetime. And we are in the very early days right now. This is like lithium ion was in 1991. It's still the Wild West. Nobody knows exactly the formulations that are going to win. And we still have a lot of learning to do, but it's clear that it has a niche for itself. It's clear that there's a market need, and we just need to get to work.
Well, it's a wonderful place to leave it. And it's been an absolutely brilliant introduction to sodium ion chemistry for me and for many of our listeners as well. So, Spencer, we will watch your progress with great interest and wish you every success in the future. It sounds like you're going to have your hands full.
Yeah, we certainly will. If there are any material scientists or chemists in the audience that are interested in maybe working on some sodium ion batteries, we'd love to hear from you.
Well, I'll make sure that all your contact details are there in the show notes. Spencer, thank you so much again. It's been great to have you on the Battery Technology Podcast.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Ken. It's been a real pleasure. You have a good one.
The Battery Technology Podcast is a copyrighted GSE Media Limited production. For more details on how to reach us, you'll find our contact details in the show notes or at our website, www.batterytechnologypodcast.com.